Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Justin McElroy.
We already did that part.
Dang.
Justin, I was trying to think as I was sitting down to come up with a topic for this week's episode. Yeah. Sometimes I try to think like, what's timely? What's going on? What's happening? What holidays or events?
What's hot? What's new? What's now?
And as I was thinking about it, I was thinking, well, the first thought I had was, well, my dad's birthday is coming up. And that's not really helpful for a medical history podcast necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Like the medical history of dads or dad's birthdays isn't really a thing.
Yeah.
Not a hot topic.
Yeah. Hot topic. Now, there would be a good one. The shirts. Is that the Joker? I love it.
I don't think that has anything
Rugrats
to do.
Rugrats on a hoodie?
That has nothing to do with my dad and or medical history podcast.
I love My Chemical Romance.
But I don't know if this is an insight into the way my brain works that I should share or not. But when I thought, well, what has to do with my dad that would have to do with medical history? I thought, oh, I wonder if paternity testing has an interesting history. I don't doubt that we share way too much sports related aggression to not be genetically related.
Sounds like a cause of death. Cause of death, sports related aggression.
But it did make me think about, you know, I bet there's an interesting history when it comes to like proving parentage. And how did we do that? Nowadays we have DNA, right? I mean, well, we always had DNA. Mm-hmm. That's not new.
You could also pretend this is about Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is just wrapped up. Paternity is huge on that show.
Right.
Lineage. This is our Game of Thrones Tommy Smurl tie-in episode. It's for both.
Yes.
If you know Tommy, but don't know Game of Thrones, go for that.
There we go.
If you know Game of Thrones but not Tommy, go for that. If you know Tommy and Game of Thrones, you're probably Mary Smurl, Sydney's mom.
There's probably like a few other people, though.
The Venn diagram probably has a few other people.
So humans, as you may imagine, have been trying to prove for various reasons conclusively who their parents were for a long time, both to prove that someone is and on the other end, prove that that's not your child necessarily. There have been great efforts made throughout history to do that before we figured out that like we have DNA and there's a good way to do that. You know, one thing I wanted to cover at the top is I had heard the myth, maybe even in a classroom, but perhaps not, the myth that up to anywhere from 10 to 30% of people don't know where the sperm that created them, where it actually came from, that the person they think, you know, fathered them is not. I've heard that myth. That is not true. It is probably a much, much, much lower number, like on the order of 1 to 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So
I had not heard this myth, so I'm assuming it might be a medical school thing because I've never heard that.
I'd heard that myth before. I've looked it up. It is considered. And
you asked me what I thought it would be, and I nailed it.
You said like 3, and like some studies have said perhaps up to 3, but like probably 1 to 2. Anyway, the point is that's not as big an issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about terminology real quick? Just because it gets a little gendered.
It does. The language when it comes to, so like if you were to look up a paternity test. What they are referencing is trying to figure out which individual the sperm came from when it came to making the child. Because there had to have been a sperm. There had to have been an egg. Mm-hmm. And maternity testing refers to figuring out who provided the egg. So those are generally like if you're going to go have these done and you're Googling to try to figure out like where can I do this and how much would it cost and what services provide them, these are the terms you would use to look up those things. Now, they are gendered terms.
Yeah, women can make sperm, men can make sperm, vice versa. Everybody can make eggs and sperm. This is the shorthand that we have, and there's not a non-gendered way of talking about parentage right now.
We could say parental testing, but I think the problem is we're looking back through history. As you may imagine, a lot of the testing, quote-unquote testing, that was done was really focused on who provided the sperm, especially when we are talking about, like, royal lineages and children that were conceived outside of a marital relationship. Mm-hmm. That's what really kind of decided where in society that child was going to fit.
Right.
Was who provided the sperm. And so a lot of it was focused on what is broadly referred to as paternity testing. But obviously, again, that it's a defect in our language. We need a non-gendered term for that other than the person from whence the sperm came.
It's very wordy.
The person
this episode will be 3 hours long.
The sperm came. In ancient Rome, proving parentage was really important because, as I said, it would change your standing in the community depending on who, you know, got busy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In scientific terms.
And yes. If a child, there was a specific term for children who were born of incestuous relationships. Hey, Game of Thrones, this is really relevant to that, right? Mm-hmm. There was some of that.
Sure, yeah.
They were called the incestuosi.
Sounds like a hot social clique.
It was not. they actually...
Because
not only did the father not necessarily have to support that child, the mother actually at the time had no like legal requirement to support a child that was born of that sort of relationship. Mm-hmm. So disproving that would be very important. Also, if it was, as I mentioned, a child. So if there is a married couple and then somebody steps out, the child that is conceived in that manner is also regarded as a lower on the social rung in ancient Rome.
Okay.
And so all of these things really mattered for potential fathers. The reason that you wanted to prove or disprove this claim became a financial one. As far back as the 6th century CE, we began to require alimony, child support, some payment to the person who would be raising the child from the other person who was involved in conceiving the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Justinian said, like, everybody's got to be held accountable no matter how the child was conceived. Mm. You're going to have to pay for it. So it became an issue because it became a financial issue. This held true for a long time. There have been, if you look into the legal history of it, it's really interesting because there was a point in history in the 1800s when, like, for instance, in France, the French Civil Code actually said that you can't force any parents to be accountable for a kid just because they had it.
Why?
I don't know. I'd have to ask French people.
Seems like a pretty good reason, French people.
I'd have to ask the French people in the 1800s. This didn't last very long. That is obviously not our modern idea of your responsibility as a parent to the child that you bore or helped to create in modern society in France or anywhere else. I believe that you have some accountability for their welfare. There were some methods of determining parentage that were based on timing of pregnancy. That was a really common way. Was just like asking about menstrual cycles and how, trying to figure out, you know, this was still a problem back before ultrasounds and such, how far along, mm-hmm. you know, how long has this person been pregnant?
I'm sure that was always tastefully handled.
No, never. There were obvious heritable traits that would be looked for, which is so.
It's like, yeah.
Touch it. So hit and miss.
He has your nose. That kind of
thing. I guess. Yeah. There were some other stranger kind of concepts. Like there was a North Germanic tribe that would have the potential if it was a male child, once they were old enough, I guess, to hold things, they would have them hold a hot metal rod. And if they were truly the son of whoever they were claiming, they could hold it.
If they have it as long as their dad, then they're like as much of a wimp as their dad. Like they let it go instantly. Like, oh, that's Phil's kid. Phil couldn't hold the hot metal rod either.
There were easy options for those who were claimed to be the father of the child, the ones who were in the paternity suit, so to speak. There were some easy ways that they could prove that they were not, in fact, involved in the conception of the child. The easiest was to prove that you were out of the country.
Yep. Have a receipt from Dunkin' Donuts in another land. You're set.
You got documentation. You got witnesses. Now, again, you said, of course, was this handled tactfully? No, because the pregnant person had to undergo an examination to try to determine the timing of the pregnancy. And so if you had the receipts, that would be one way of denying paternity. The other way was to prove that you could not impregnate anyone under any circumstances. So they had to hold an impotence trial.
That's so rad. not so fast. I'm taking you to court. Impotence court. To prove that I, Phil, could not have sired that child.
To all of our Phils listening,
yeah, I don't
I'm
know. Sorry, Phil. You're getting a rough go of it this time. I don't know, bud.
So these were defined as legal sexual fights.
Legal sexual fights.
Sexual fights.
Like foxy boxing.
And basically what you would have to do, there was a congressus. So there were some surgeons, some official priests, some matrons, various people who I guess were good at judging these kinds of things.
Right.
And you would have to go before them in person and demonstrate your inability to become erect and ejaculate.
Boy, that's a full afternoon, I tell you. That is a lot to have to deal with, I feel like.
And if you could successfully prove that you were incapable, then that would eliminate you as a potential sperm donor from the equation because you couldn't. So
that's what that scene in A Few Good Men is about. Did you know that? Jack. Tom Cruise is like,
I've never seen A Few Good Men, but I'm guessing it's not.
No, it's actually absolutely about what you just described exactly verbatim.
Now, these sexual fights were problematic in that, Justin, would you say it would be difficult as a I am not a penis haver. As someone who is, Justin, would you say it would be difficult to do this in front of a courtroom full of people?
Here's what I'll say.
Any circumstances.
I'll make this blanket statement, okay, Squid? Let me make this blanket statement. For most people with a penis, yes. For a certain segment of people with penises, 100% no. I can't say unilaterally. I would guess for the majority of people, yes. For a slim minority, oh, it's not going to be a problem whatsoever. This is my whole thing. This is my whole jam. I've dreamt of this my entire life. This is my moment to crank it in a courtroom.
If you
do they have lawyer?
Yeah, I mean it was a legal proceeding.
It is illegal.
This is how if you wanted to prove that
it is a legal erection. It's a legally binding erection.
If you wanted to prove that
judge.
That wasn't your
did they need a judge
child
to judge
this is how it went down. And you were not in doubting this. You were not alone. We've talked about a famous French surgeon Ambroise Paré before on the show.
He's up in the historic rebuff, right?
No.
Oh.
Paré?
He published the complete works that had stuff about
Yes, he did have stuff. You're right. We've talked about him in so many episodes. He was like instrumental in wound care and amputation and important French surgeon. But he also, his comment on this, which he did not publish while he was alive, he wrote it and then it was published after he died.
Put this in a file.
Listen, it would be pretty impossible for most people to perform in this arena, and I don't know that this is a great way.
What a prudish time that you can't even say that while you're alive. Like, listen, this is off my blue side. All right, this one, send the kids to bed. Let me tell you my opinion about erection court.
There were other medical arguments that people could prove a little bit easier. People who were claiming they were not responsible for the conception of a child. So there was an Italian physician in 1595, Giovanni Battista Condronchi,
got it. Yeah,
who talked about that if you had excessive liquid evacuation, then you may not be able to.
You mean too much?
Yeah.
Sperm. Not sperm. Like semen.
Yes.
That's the word.
Yeah. Well, also like if you masturbate a lot.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like if it was too liquidy.
You'll lose sperm quality. Oh. And that if you don't eat enough, you'll lose sperm quality.
True.
Any deformities of the genitals. He also specifically targeted overweight people and said that basically there's too much. There's like fat in the blood, like actual adipose tissue. There's fat in the blood, and that you couldn't make good sperm. So that could be a defense use. Like, I am too overweight to have provided good sperm, and so I could not have possibly been involved in the conception of this
child.
That's
true too, right? About
being overweight, none of that is true. None of that is true. No, that is not true. So if you could prove any of that, you could claim I couldn't. It's not me. Couldn't be me.
Couldn't be me. No overweight person has ever gotten anybody pregnant.
That doesn't
even stand up to basic, like, that's threadbare, and well, I gotta say.
They get called out on this eventually. Don't worry.
Oh, there's Giovanni, a lot not of. Emma. Sorry.
No, that was Giovanni. But there was a lot of kind of ridiculous claims that I have not. I don't have historical proof for this, but they speak of kind of like, hey, I got your back, buddy. Hey, don't worry, bro.
Actually, all Derek's are impotent. So my friend Derek could not have done this.
That is not true. All Derek's are impotent. All Derek's are not. I'm sorry, Derek's. I am sorry to all of the Derek's. So there was also the Fortunatus Fidelis from Italy.
That was a character, Sydney. Right. That was a lawyer character I was playing.
I know. I just am apologizing to all the Derek's and Phil's who you've offended with our podcast.
Fair enough.
He also stated that if you had a crooked penis...
Hold on. Let me listen more intently to this part for no reason in particular. Go ahead.
What now?
I said, let me listen to this part for no reason in particular.
Okay. Also, he described a penis of such large size.
All right, I'm going to tune out.
That any sort of sexual intercourse would be of mortal danger to the woman.
38 years old.
And so it is impossible that this person could actually have vaginal intercourse.
That is verbatim the title of the first porno tape ever made was a penis of such large size that sexual intercourse must be a mortal danger to the woman is the name of the first ever pornography video cassette. From the 1600s.
And so fertilization and paternity would be impossible.
That is the second. That's the sequel.
If you had all these options that you had to claim in front of a judge, why didn't everybody claim that one? Why were some people in there and they were like, my doctor says I'm too overweight, when another option would have been, my doctor says my penis is too big.
I had what most men, what was he saying? I had penis reduction surgery. Sydney, I have to know more. I don't even care what about. I just have to keep going.
Obviously, in this, so the patriarchy is running amok on this topic.
They're having a lot of fun.
They're just all over it.
The patriarchy's getting a little buck
science
wild.
Is going to have to call them into question. But before we get there, let's go to the billing department.
Let's go.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
You know, it's tempting to say, I'm going to start on the big new thing. You know, when the new year comes, I'm going to get it all figured out. Here's what I want to tell you. There's never been a better time to start your dream than right this second. And there's never been a better way to start than with Squarespace. We've been telling you about Squarespace for years, and that's because it's simply the best way to make a website. I mean, there's no other way to put it than that, folks. People have been using Squarespace to make incredible professional-looking websites. And they look professional because the templates they're using, they are made by real web designers. So they're making, like, building blocks that are going to look great. You just bring your stuff, your images, your things you want to sell, any of that, and Squarespace is going to help you make a great platform for it. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. We were going through our Christmas gift list over here at the McElroy household, and there were at least two folks this year that are getting Aura frames. Now, I can't tell you who because I don't want to spoil the surprise, but it is really hard to find gifts for people that you really care about and make it feel like personal, you know? But Aura is a really great way of doing that. It's a great digital photo frame. It is named the number one, actually, by Wirecutter, the strategist, Wired. We could go on. It's a really lovely gift to give to somebody. Maybe even if they're not, like, super tech savvy, you can set this photo frame up ahead of time. And then once it's there in their home, if you are out and about and you capture a memory you want to share, you can use the Aura app to just send it, like, directly to that frame. So, like, you're making the memories and you're sharing the memories, like, within minutes. Can you imagine? That's a lovely gift for somebody that you care about. They're going to be able to keep up with your life. And hey, if you've gotten them one before, maybe in another room. Maybe they could have a themed room. You know, in this room, I only want pictures of Justin. What a room that would be. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver mat frames named number one by Wirecutter by using promo code Sawbones at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code Sawbones. This deal is exclusive to listeners and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
So in the 1600s, we began to develop some pathways to figuring out, like, what the problem is. We didn't really understand fertility well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, before we can start figuring out, like, who are the parents of this child,
right?
We have to figure out, like, how are babies made?
Right. We're a long way away from that.
And we're still, like, there's still a lot of debate. A lot of people had the idea that it was really just the sexual act. And not necessarily any sort of exchange of fluids
or anything. Right.
So, like, the ejaculation was removed from the idea of fertility for mm-hmm. a while. This started to change in the 1600s when we found sperm. First we had to have a microscope and then we could look at some semen and go, whoa.
Oh, hello.
What are these animalcules?
That you think that word just came to them unbidden?
Well, that was a common term for tiny little things that move and we don't know what they are.
That must have been buck wild the first time they were like, hey, you guys better get over here. There have been tadpoles in here the entire time. They're in the stuff. You know the stuff? There have been tadpoles in it. I kid you not. Come look, quick.
People were pretty freaked out. And it really challenged the idea that if there is a penis and there is a vagina, a baby can happen. Nothing else is needed. All of a sudden, we begin to get the idea that, well, there's something else happening. There's a Swiss anatomy professor, Albrecht von Haller, in the 1700s, who said, anyway, sexual intercourse requires a perfect instrument. But to father a child, a little bit more is needed.
All right.
So throughout the next 200 years, there would be a lot more study on What are sperm? What do they do? What about ova? How about that? What about the other part of the equation? We need an egg as well to try to figure out how everything worked. But all of this doesn't really tell you who the parent is. It helps you figure out who the parent isn't, right?
Right.
Because
which is a slow and inefficient way of determining parentage.
Exactly. If the only thing we're focusing on are, I mean, let's be honest, people with penises who want to say, not it.
Not
I mean,
me.
That's, I can't look. There's no sperm in there, so it wasn't me. That's pretty much all this so far we were able to figure out. And as a result, even into the 20th century, if you asked a doctor to testify with expert medical opinion as to could this individual be, you know, responsible for this child? Do you think that this is the person who was involved in the conception of this child? It was really just their opinion and their experience. Wow. There was no scientific grounding for this. A lot of it still had to do with proximity and timing. Did these two people have sex around the time that we right. think this child probably was conceived? But there were other, as in 1909, there was R. Gottschalk, who published an outline of forensic medicine, because that's what we're starting to get into, right? Forensics, trying to figure out what happened here, not necessarily diagnose or treat anything. He wrote that in no other area have so many unbelievable lies and impudent claims been put before the forensic task as in this accounts of infertility, because doctors would go before judges and say, nah, he was too sick to have had a kid, so it wasn't him, or he was his penis is deformed, or he has a tumor there that will stop it, whether or not this was true. The genitals were an unusual size. There were
genitals of unusual size. I don't believe they exist.
There were doctors who would actually claim that while yes, I through my examinations, I have concluded that the two individuals in question did have sex at the appropriate time to have conceived this child, I do not believe it is possible for the man to have ejaculated because the woman is not attractive enough. This was an actual legal defense.
I'm sorry from all of us.
Thank you for your apology.
Sorry. I'm sorry again for everything, the whole thing.
So even as these claims began to be seen as ridiculous, even as, you know, obviously there were other scientists and doctors saying, like, you can't just go into a courtroom and say, like, nope, couldn't have happened because of something that you have no scientific grounding for.
Right.
That's just your opinion. Our one tool that we could actually use to determine if you know, because the common thing was, well, I've never been responsible for parenting a child before, you know, like especially if it was like an extramarital affair, then usually it was usually a man would say, well, I have no children with my wife, so obviously I can't have children, so I couldn't have been the parent of this child. An easy thing to do would be to examine the semen for sperm. In order to do that, though, you got to get a sample. Right. Which requires masturbation.
Right.
And at the time, in the early part of the 20th century, there were a lot of doctors who believed that it was detrimental to one's health to masturbate.
Oh.
So they could not ask a patient to do so in order for them to examine it under a microscope because it would violate our primary tenet of do no harm, because they'd be asking them to harm themselves.
Yes.
So that all seems rather convenient to me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so there was no proof there. There was also, even when you would do that, if you would see that the sperm weren't moving, the idea, are these sperm not capable of motility, which could be a cause of infertility. There was a common belief that the sperm don't come to life until they're inside.
So you put a special plaid hat on them and every night they.
So they would just say, well, the sperm aren't moving because they're not inside the vaginal canal. That's when they really get moving. So. Doesn't prove anything. The real breakthrough when it came to this kind of testing came with the discovery of blood types by Karl Landsteiner. Basically, we can use, you remember Punnett squares?
Yes.
From science class, Gregor Mendel. His pea plants. Yeah. So basic Mendelian genetics helped in this case. So we could use the blood types of the two people in question and the blood type of the child to figure out if it is possible at all that this person may have been one of the parents of the child, right?
Right.
And for both, really. Because there are certain, if you do the Punnett square, there are certain blood types that could not have produced a child with this blood type,
right,
basically, without getting into all of the specifics. Now, of course, this isn't perfect. It was still like, you could definitely rule people out, like maybe 30% of the time, but then that was it. You
can't prove anything.
You can't prove anything for sure because people have the same blood type. Later, we figured out Rh groups. That's the positive, negative, A positive or A negative, that part of it. And that helped even a little bit more, but it's still an imperfect test. A good example of this was Charlie Chaplin.
All right. What?
He was claimed to have fathered a child of Joan Barry in 1946. They did blood group testing and it ruled him out as a possible parent, but the judge didn't buy it because at the time it was considered unreliable.
Wow.
So he had to pay child support anyway. So like I said, this led to a lot of inconclusive results. We looked for better tests throughout the 1930s. We did like protein marker testing. Like there were different blood tests that were developed. There was in the 1960s, we did this HLA typing, which has to do with certain genetic markers that we can find on white blood cells. So you could take a sample of the blood, look at the white blood cells, look for these certain markers, and that could help up to 80% accuracy.
Okay.
But it had a lot of trouble with close relatives. So if you're not sure
which of the
like brothers or whatever, you know, that would get problematic.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know what? It already sounds problematic.
It does. That sounds very problematic. So finally, as we started to understand DNA in our genes and how to do genetic testing, that was really the breakthrough. And that didn't happen until the 70s and then into the 80s when we found that, you know, we all have unique genetic codes and they are made up of the two people who parented us. And we can take some of the DNA out of our cells and replicate it. That was a big breakthrough with polymerase chain reaction, meaning we can make many, many copies of a piece of DNA. And then we can either cut it into little pieces and look for certain pieces that match, or we can look for repeating fragments of DNA that we all have or that are all different among us, but we would have gotten from one parent or the other. So they found all these ways to do this throughout the 70s and the 80s. And now with DNA, all we have to do now is either take a blood sample or even easier, a cheek swab. Mm-hmm. Swab the inside of your cheek, get some cells, open them up, crack open the DNA, compare it, and with 99.99% accuracy, we can predict if somebody is a parent or not.
There's some part of you that thinks that this would have been a fun line of work to go into, doesn't it?
It sounds very cool.
It seems there's an animation I'm seeing from you that makes me think that you wish you had gotten into.
We do a little bit of this like throughout like labs. Well, I mean, I did in my college, like chemistry labs and stuff and biochem and things. And it's just fascinating to think about. We would do these like gel electrophoresis, separate out the different pieces of DNA that we broke apart with restriction enzymes. It's really interesting. I don't know. I just think it's very cool. But it's the same idea as we've done an episode on genetic testing before. We can do that and we can figure out who your parents are. You can do that. A lot of people ask, can you do that while like a person is pregnant? Can you figure out who the other parent is while the person is still pregnant? You can. There's one sample there's one way of doing it that's invasive. It's called chorionic villus sampling, where you actually have to stick a needle in and get a sample from inside the uterus during the pregnancy. And there are some, I mean, they're slight risks, but there are some risks to that.
Right.
There's another way to do it now where we can just look for fetal cells from the fetus in the blood, like by getting a peripheral blood draw from the parent, which is pretty cool. So you can do that, or you can just wait till after the baby's born too. It's still a problem with identical twins.
Oh yeah.
They have the exact same genetic code.
So you couldn't prove?
You couldn't prove which one is the parent.
How interesting.
There was a case in Brazil this year where two men were ordered to pay child support for the same child because they could not conclusively prove which one was the dad.
Wow, weird.
I know. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Another interesting exception are chimeras. So
the mythological beast?
No.
Ah, no mistake.
That's a different thing, isn't it?
Chimera?
Is that a chimera? Let me tell you, while you're looking, I see you're Googling. While you're Googling, let me tell you what a chimera is. So
fire breathing monster with a lion's head, a goat's body, and a serpent's tail.
Oh. Yeah. Well, that is not what I'm referencing.
Okay.
Animals can be chimera, and humans are animals, so we can too. So basically, every cell in your body has the same DNA inside the nucleus, right? We have the same genetic code inside the nucleus. Right. Every body cell, no matter where it is in your body, it's all the same. Except for genetic chimeras. They have two different cell lineages in their body. The most common way this happens, I think this is the easiest way to understand what I'm saying. If you imagine that there are two eggs inside the uterus and two different sperm fertilize those two eggs, and then very early in the zygote process, in the formation process, the two fuse into one. They're like two people in one.
Wow.
And so there are two completely different genetic codes scattered throughout their body. Most of the time you don't know. Like, this wouldn't be something that would be readily, you wouldn't see anything. Everything would look fine.
Super strength.
No. Occasionally you'll see like different color eyes or different patches of different colored skin that might indicate that this is true. You wouldn't necessarily ever know that this was true. A calico cat is a great example of this. Calico cats are chimeras. That's why they got the different colors of fur. Now, what's interesting is
why aren't calico cats more rare then? It seems like there's a lot of those.
I think they are more rare than other types, aren't they?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, here's the question. Like, are chimeras less rare? There are other reasons that a person can be a chimera. This is just the most common. But are they less rare than we know? We all have a little bit of other cells in us. Typically there's exchange over the placenta. Anyway, this doesn't matter. The point is, in 2002, Lydia Fairchild was a case where she was getting divorced. She was pregnant with her third child, and she was trying to get child support for her other two children and the one that was on the way. And that was, it was standard at the time to do a proof of paternity to prove that who she was saying was the dad was the dad of her children. And they also got blood from her. And what they found is that while, yes, this indeed was the father of the children, she could not possibly be the mother of her two children. Now, initially, prosecutors jumped on this and tried to take her children away from her, thought she was running some sort of scam. Nobody knew exactly what the nature of the scam. Why?
What a scam that would be.
Yeah, that's as someone who's raising two children right now, I don't know why that would be the scam.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she was taken to court over this, and she kept insisting, no, they're my kids. And like, nobody was like, we have no evidence that they're not her kids. Like, we don't know what's going on with this testing. So what the judge had was someone present in the delivery room when she gave birth to her third child. And then very shortly after, they took blood samples from both that child and Lydia Fairchild. And they found that she could not possibly be the mother of that child, but they had witnessed her giving birth to it.
Yeah.
So, one of the defense lawyers read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about a different woman from Boston named Karen Keegan, who was a chimera, who had chimerism. So they theorized perhaps this could be the same. So for their client, they took DNA samples from different places in her body, and they found that even though her skin and her hair did not match her children's DNA, they did a cervical smear, like a pap smear test. The cells from there had the same DNA and proved that she was the mother of the children, because they're just cells from the two different cell lines in her body.
Wow.
Interesting case, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's easy now, right? We fixed it. We solved this one.
Yeah, we're really good. I mean, I guess if you ever watch the Maury Povich show, I think that's all it is these days.
I never miss one.
Is that. But yeah, with 99.99% certainty, we can figure out who parents are, or vice versa. Even like if a parent isn't present, you can like backwards construct. If you've got like one parent's DNA and the child's DNA, you can figure out the genetic code of the other parent, even without having them present.
What a wild time.
Yes.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to Sawbones. We hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Happy birthday, Dad.
Happy birthday, Tommy.
He should do a court appointed on this.
Yes.
There's a great legal history.
Listen to Tommy's podcast. It's a legal podcast. If you like Sawbones, listen to Court Appointed.
He does it with my Uncle Michael, who's a real lawyer.
He's an actual lawyer, in the same way that Sydney's an actual doctor. If you remember to renew your license, don't forget to renew your your license. I'm reminding you here on the podcast.
I will.
Okay. I just remember.
It's just like money. Everybody out there, it's just money. They just have to pay. Such a racket.
It is a racket. Thank you to the Max Fun Network for having us as part of their extended podcasting family. We are going to be on the road pretty soon. If you want to come see us live, I don't know if we've even mentioned this. You can come see us real soon. We're going to be at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville on June 15th and the Klaus Memorial Hall in Indianapolis on June 16th, appearing before my brother and me. If you go to bit.ly/ Become the Monster, I think is the address that'll work. You can also go to McElroy.family and click on tours, and you can see links to buy tickets for those. Come see us in Schmanners and my brother, me in Nashville and Indianapolis.
Can I give a shout out to the authors of this paper that I use for a lot of this?
Oh, of course.
Albrecht and Schultheis wrote Proof of Paternity, Historical Reflections on an Andrological Forensic Challenge that was instrumental in the construction of this podcast. Just an excellent article. I usually don't find so much info in one article, and there it was. So if you're interested, shout out. There you go.
I think that'll do it for us, folks, for this week. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Match Game. Our contestants, Aneke and James from the hit podcast Minority Corner. Hey. I'll ask you questions in a rapid fire round. Favorite character on a Shonda Rhimes show?
Olivia Pope.
Ooh, I said Olivia Pope's wig.
Oh, so close. How do you feel about Disney?
They need to pay reparations to black people because Mickey Mouse was based off of blackface.
I said get rid of the racist rides, Jungle Cruise, Splash Mountain.
Who are you voting for in the primary?
It's too damn early.
I'm just getting to know these fools.
Ooh, no dice. What celebrity do you side-eye the most?
Kevin Hart. Can we get a real apology for your homophobia?
Justin Timberlake.
Nipplegate.
Favorite superhero movie?
Black Panther. Wakanda forever.
Congratulations, but you still lose.
Now I'm side-eyeing you.
Catch Aneke and James, the Wonder Twins of podcasts, on Minority Corner every Friday at Maximum Fun.